Good morning, Colorado. You're listening to the Daily Sunup. The Daily Sunup podcast is a conversation with the Colorado Sun. See our trust indicators at coloradosun.com/ethics. It's Friday, June 7th. Today, Sun writer and Sunlit editor Kevin Simpson chats with an author whose memoir explores the challenges, joys, and pain faced by siblings and other family members of people with developmental disabilities. Before we begin, Elevation Music Festival is back. Join us in Alma, Colorado, August 16th to 17th for an unforgettable weekend of top-tier music against stunning mountain vistas. Enjoy world-class performances and immerse yourself in the beauty of the highest incorporated town in North America. Don't miss out. Visit ElevationMusicFest.com for more information. Now, let's go back in time with some Colorado history. During World War II, the federal government sent German and Italian POWs to Colorado. Enlisted men worked as manual laborers, harvesting crops and maintaining Camp Hale, though POWs refused to work in coal mines. Internees living on subsistence diets often planned escapes. In 1944, some Germans, aided by an American soldier, escaped to Mexico but were caught. When asked, POWs often stated that they preferred Colorado to combat in a war they were losing. On this day in 1964, former German POWs returned for a reunion in Trinidad, organized by city officials. They toured historic sites, honored American forces, and visited the camp's ruins. The reunion was praised as a symbol of friendship, and the former German soldiers noting the overwhelming hospitality of the Americans. Before we continue, join the Colorado Sun on June 25th as Equity reporter Tatiana Flowers speaks with a panel about how they see mental illness falling through the cracks, what some solutions are, or ways to address the issues, and more. The event is free and virtual. RSVP today at coloradosun.com/events. Next, our feature story.
Well, it's finally Friday, listeners, and today we're joined by the Boulder author, Gina DeMillo Wagner, who's written a compelling new book titled Forces of Nature, a memoir of family loss and finding home, which draws on her experience growing up with a sibling with developmental disabilities. Thanks for joining us, Gina.
Thanks for having me.
So the impetus for this book was an essay that you wrote for the New York Times. Tell us about that and what convinced you that this was a topic that you wanted to tackle in a full-length memoir.
When I was going through the loss of my brother and the grief, I looked around for other stories that kind of validated or mirrored the experience I was having as a sibling to someone who had some severe disabilities. And I really didn't see a lot out there about the experience of growing up alongside someone with disability, but then also the complicated grief that happens when you lose somebody who had high needs. So I wrote the New York Times piece specifically just to kind of capture a snapshot of the grieving process. And at the time, I thought I was writing something that would really speak to other siblings. And I was kind of surprised when I heard back from people who grew up in all sorts of complicated families, you know, where they had to kind of quiet their own needs because there were bigger things going on in the family or somebody else always needed more, whether that was due to disability or mental illness or addiction or any number of, you know, dysfunctional things that tend to disrupt families.
So let's talk a little bit about Alan. Tell us about who Alan was. An older sibling, right?
Yes, he was my older brother, 3 years older than me. One of the things that was interesting, though, growing up is that at a pretty young age, I surpassed him developmentally. So even though he was older and I was the younger sister, in a lot of ways, I felt like the oldest sibling. I felt very protective of him. I was able to do things that he wasn't able to do, which, you know, I think there's a little bit of survivor's guilt around that when you realize that you're having experiences that a sibling of yours can't have. But yeah, he was 3 years older. He was honestly one of the most loving, funniest people I've ever known. But then also, as you know, he from reading the book, he could, would also be really violent. So he was somebody who I loved and I also feared.
So let's talk a little about the title of the book, Forces of Nature. Where does that come from and what does that mean to you?
Yeah, it means a lot of different things. I think, you know, Alan himself was a force of nature, both in his personality and his physical stature. As adults, he was, you know, twice as big as me. So he definitely was a force of nature. His condition was genetic. So there was a kind of a force of nature in that, a momentum that was driven by having this genetic disability. There's forces of nature that come into play in terms of, you know, families of origin and families of choice and the forces that kind of shape who we become as people in childhood and as adults. And then for me personally, the places I've lived, the landscapes that I've traveled, and nature have been a force for healing in my life. So I wanted to capture that in the title too.
So in general, what do you think distinguishes the sibling experience that you had in your family with, from the way others experienced relationships with Alan and all the nuances therein?
Yeah, there's a very common experience among siblings to people with disabilities. And even in the healthiest of families, there's some patterns that emerge because, you know, what happens is maybe your sibling is going for doctor's appointments or they have intense educational needs or behavioral needs. And so as a sibling, like even when I think parents do a good job of giving attention to everybody in the family, the typical sibling still sense that somebody else needs more and that you have to kind of be quiet and not rock the boat. For a lot of people, that looks like living in opposition to your sibling. So if your sibling has special needs, then you have no needs. If they struggle intellectually and academically, then a lot of times siblings become overachievers and perfectionists because they just are trying to make things right or set the balance in the family. And then I think this is changing as awareness has grown in recent years, but there's a lot more focus on parenting somebody with a disability. And a lot of times the siblings are just invisible. You know, their experience is not really acknowledged. They're not given the room to have ambivalent feelings about it, you know, kind of the overwhelming joy and pride and all the wonderful things that come along with disability, but also maybe the grief and the resentment that also comes along with it.
So personally, how did you fit in to the family, given what you just described there about the range of possibilities?
Yeah, I mean, my experience was unique, but I think it resonates with people in the sense that I became another parent in the family. My parents split up at a very young age, when I was at a very young age, and my mother had some untreated mental health issues. And so I was kind of called on to help caretake and my brothers, but also, you know, cook dinner. And I was doing a lot of the things that a parent should do in that situation. So I feel like I grew up at a very young age. I had a lot of responsibilities. By the time I was, you know, 10, 12 years old, I was babysitting and giving my money to my mom to help pay some bills. And then, yeah, I was participating in the physical care of my brothers as well.
Oh. So I want to mention here that we've got an excerpt from the book running in our Sunlit feature starting Sunday. And I've got to say that the emotional tension that you describe in this opening scene, learning of your brother's death, is so vivid that I have to ask, wordsmithing aside, how difficult was this book to write on an emotional level?
You know, I have a long history of professional writing, and I don't know if that made things a little bit easier for me. Like, I think the actual act of writing the manuscript, I approached very similar to some, you know, long form journalistic writing that I've done in the past. And that could have been just maybe a coping mechanism. But I want to say that a lot of the emotional work that I did to be able to write this book, I did off the page. You know, I have been in therapy. I've had a lot of people in my life who were able to hear this story before I ever wrote a word of it. So I think when it came time to actually put it down, you know, it didn't feel as raw as you might think. I think I'd done a lot of that emotional processing before I started writing.
You talk about a switch being flipped as you learned of Alan's death. What changed for you in terms of how you'd move forward with your life? And did this experience sort of raise questions that you knew you'd one day you'd have to confront, but had been able to kind of keep below the surface for many years?
It definitely surfaced some questions. It's interesting, you know, these big before and after moments that happen in life where you get a piece of bad news or you lose somebody suddenly. It's not, in some ways, because of his disabilities and his high medical needs, my entire life I had imagined what it might be like when he died. You know, it was kind of always in my consciousness that he had these issues, but I was still completely thrown by the news. And yeah, the questions that emerged ended up kind of being the driving questions, you know, throughout the memoir, but in my life too. You know, I wanted to know, because of his intellectual disabilities, did he know that I loved him? Could he feel that love? Did he know that people could fear him and also love him? Because our relationship was really complicated, I felt like I inherited a lot of what ifs and unknowns. And my grieving process was really, you know, trying to work through those questions and then find peace with the questions that don't have answers.
Well, it as quickly becomes apparent in the excerpt from the start of the book, but your family, as you've mentioned, like a lot of families, featured some difficult relationships. How did you approach telling your story sort of in that mix amid the stress of family dynamics that already existed?
As I was writing the story, was primarily focused on trying to capture my experience with as much truth and grace and fairness as possible. I think, you know, when you're writing memoir, obviously you kind of have to find the boundaries between where your story ends and someone else's story begins. But really, in order to write the book, I thought about the fact that my entire early life, I centered their experiences and their opinions. And so for this project, really, I kind of had to put that out of my mind and focus on my experience and my relationship with Alan.
So how did you feel when you finished the book? Did you need affirmation from your family or from others, or were they really not part of the audience that you were trying to reach here?
They definitely weren't my target audience. I was thinking a lot about, you know, the readers of the New York Times essay. I felt like I was writing it for people who responded to that, the people who were really hungry for more narratives about what it's like to love somebody without abandoning yourself in the process. And then I also really felt like my audience was a younger version of myself. I was writing the thing that I wish I had had when I was going through it. So it felt like a gift to my younger self, and then hopefully a gift to a lot of people out there who want to feel seen in their experiences.
Well, tell us about some of the themes or facets of your story that were most important for you to convey here.
Yeah, aside from the sibling experience, I thought a lot about grief and kind of the way our culture views grief. I feel like we're not great as a culture at allowing for grief, and specifically for complicated grief. You know, the grief that happens when you lose somebody who you had a complicated relationship with. And so I wanted to offer a story that would speak to that particular type of grief, the one where there's not necessarily a neat linear process that you go through, where maybe the finish line is not always acceptance or feeling like all your questions have answers. Because I think what happens a lot of times is that we rush each other through grief, like we kind of try to get over it too quickly, or we rush ourselves through it. So yeah, that was one of the themes I really wanted to kind of put out there, is this one particular grief experience that may not fit into the five neat stages that we tend to hear about.
Did you feel at all that writing this book was cathartic or therapeutic, or were you sort of beyond that stage and this was just more of a professional undertaking?
Yeah, it wasn't 100% professional, but I do feel like a lot of the catharsis and healing happened outside of the writing process. I think there's a little bit of a misconception that writing a memoir alone is the thing that will heal you. I think it's one tool and it's one part of the process, but really when you've gone through something really profound, I think the thing that's most healing, aside from making shape and meaning of your story, is having people witness it and validate it and believe it, and then finding ways to kind of reconnect to yourself in the aftermath of something really traumatic.
Well, once again, the name of the book is Forces of Nature, a memoir of family, loss, and finding home by Gina DeMillo Wagner. It's available at fine bookstores everywhere, and be sure to read the excerpt this Sunday at coloradosun.com. Thanks for joining us, Gina.
Thank you.
And listeners, if you enjoy the podcast, please leave a review on whatever platform you use to tune in. Thanks, and we'll do this again next week.
You can read more at coloradosun.com. Finally, here are a few stories that you should know about today. A Colorado woman who was seriously injured when a freight train hit the parked police vehicle in which she sat handcuffed will receive an $8.5 million settlement. A lawyer representing two of the police officers involved said the city of Fort Lupton and nearby town of Platteville, which together employed the three officers sued in the 2022 crash, will each pay half of the settlement. The Fort Lupton police chief said the settlement recognizes the gravity of this matter. The woman had been pulled over after a road rage incident that police said involved menacing with a handgun. With about 18,000 visitors crowding into Denver's Civic Center Park and the Denver Art Museum last weekend, organizers are calling the inaugural Outside Festival a glowing success. And now, plans are underway for next year's early June gathering. The goal for the Outside Festival was to create a first-of-its-kind event blending music, films, gear demos, panel discussions, and an outdoor industry trade show into a gathering that becomes a must-attend annual event. The head of Colorado's Outdoor Recreation Office, which partnered with Outside Inc. to host the festival, said they are ready to keep building on the momentum. Governor Jared Polis has signed a bill that requires Colorado schools to provide free period products for all middle and high school students by 2028. Eligible school districts can apply to receive grant funding for these products or dispensers, and all rural school districts are eligible to apply. Lawmakers who backed the bill say having free period products at schools can reduce the embarrassment that comes with unexpectedly bleeding in class and can help students feel supported and dignified while learning. For more information on all of these stories, visit our website, coloradosun.com. And don't forget to tune in again next time. Now a quick message from our team.
This is Michael Booth.
And this is John Ingold. We cover health and climate here at the Colorado Sun.
Every week, John and I work together to send out a newsletter to our premium members called The Temperature.
In this newsletter, we share our latest reporting about health and climate and how they intersect, issues like forever chemicals, healthcare's rising costs, and the lingering effects of the pandemic. The Temperature is one of our weekly newsletters available to members at the premium level.
To sign up, head to coloradosun.com/join. Not only will you be able to sign up for The Temperature and our other premium newsletters, but you'll be supporting the Colorado Sun as a member, and thanks for doing that.